Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, March 27, 2024. U.S. Coast Guard transitions from Search and Rescue 4 to recovery of the six construction workers still unaccounted for when the cargo ship hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing it to collapse in Baltimore. The National Transportation Safety Board is stepping up its investigation of the disaster. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says there are four transportation-related focus areas of the Biden administration: reopening the port of Baltimore, he said no timeline on that yet, dealing with supply chain problems, rebuilding the bridge, and addressing surface transportation needs of the cars and trucks that no longer have a bridge to cross. We'll also get the latest just ahead on supply chain management with Professor Robert Hansfield on the potential economic impact of the loss of the bridge and the closure of the port. Disney Corporation and a Florida board supported by Governor Ron DeSantis reach a settlement after years of litigation. The governor is asked about that today. First Lady Jill Biden meets with insurance company CEOs about the administration's Cancer Moonshot initiative. She thanks them for recent steps to cover the cost of assistance known as Cancer Patient Navigators. Reports that Israel's prime minister may now send a delegation to the U.S. to discuss alternatives to Israel's planned military incursion into Rafah in Gaza to root out Hamas fighters. The White House confirms they are talking about that. And the U.S. State Department comments about Russia's targeting this week of Ukrainian energy infrastructure, its most intense bombardment of the war. From WBAL-TV in Baltimore, recovery efforts have resumed Wednesday at the site of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge. Divers returned to the site after challenging overnight conditions improved, scouring the waters for any signs of six missing workers. The six people unaccounted for and presumed dead were part of a construction crew repairing potholes on the bridge. The focus will soon shift to two main objectives: investigating what happened and reopening the channel as quickly and safely as possible. That was from WBAL-TV, Baltimore. At the White House today, an update from Vice Admiral Peter Gautier, U.S. Coast Guard Deputy Commandant.
The Coast Guard and the response community is deeply saddened that the missing individuals have not survived. And the Coast Guard appreciates the state of Maryland's leadership and humanity in supporting the family members of the missing. I'd like to personally thank the state and local responders for their heroic search and rescue efforts. While we didn't achieve the outcome that we had hoped for, it was a tremendous team effort in the treacherous operational conditions. As this aspect of the response shift to recovery operations, and consistent with the President's direction to get the port up and running as soon as possible, the Coast Guard's highest priority now is restoring the waterway for shipping, stabilizing the motor vessel dolly and removing it from the site, and coordinating a maritime casualty investigation under the leadership of the National Transportation and Safety Board. So just a couple of words on each one of those. So in terms of assessing restoring the waterway, the Coast Guard is very tightly connected to the Army Corps of Engineers as they lead in that role as the lead federal agency for that effort. As we were in the Oval Office, the President called General Spellman, the chief of the Army Corps of Engineers, who is on site. General Spellman and I had a number of conversations yesterday in terms of the coordinated approach moving forward, and they are moving very aggressively and putting resources and mobilizing the necessary equipment, conducting the analysis and the underwater surveys to do that.
Vice Admiral Peter Gautier, U.S. Coast Guard Deputy Commandant for Operations, part of his statement today at the White House briefing in Washington. The National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy telling CNN that investigators have boarded the ship that crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge and recovered its data recorder, the so-called black box, and that the agency will look into whether dirty fuel played a role in the ship's loss of power that then led the ship to run into the bridge. Also at the White House briefing today, the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who said the Biden administration is focusing on those four areas related to transportation as the investigation continues in Baltimore: reopening the port, dealing with supply chain issues, rebuilding the bridge, and addressing surface transportation.
We are going to be working with NTSB as they lead their independent investigation. It's too early to speculate, of course, what NTSB will find, but if they discover or determine anything that should be considered in the regulation, inspection, design, or funding of bridges in the future, we will be ready to apply those findings. What we do know is a bridge like this one, completed in the 1970s, was simply not made to withstand a direct impact on a critical support pier from a vessel that weighs about 200 million pounds, orders of magnitude bigger than cargo ships that were in service in that region at the time that the bridge was first built. We also know that this is yet another demonstration of the importance of our roads and bridges, which is one of many reasons why the Biden-Harris administration worked so hard to get the infrastructure package passed, and why roads and bridges are the single biggest category in that package. We are committed to delivering every federal resource needed to help Maryland get back to normal, and we're going to work with them every step of the way to rebuild this bridge. It is not going to be simple. When we helped Pennsylvania and California swiftly reopen I-95 and I-10 respectively, there was terrific done work there, but that was addressing comparatively short spans of bridges over land relative to this span over water. And of course, in the Baltimore case, we still don't fully know the condition of the portions of the bridge that are still standing or of infrastructure that is below the surface of the water. So rebuilding will not be quick or easy or cheap, but we will get it done. As I mentioned, Rollitt, we're working with city, county, and state. And I also want to add that we've been closely engaged with the Maryland congressional delegation, many of whom were on hand yesterday, and who are doing a tremendous job advocating for their state. They made it clear that they will work with us to push for any help that we need from Congress. Bottom line, as President Biden has made clear, the federal government will provide all of the support that Maryland and Baltimore need for as long as it takes, and we will work with Congress to deliver on that. I'll end with this. For the families of those presumed lost, for the people of Baltimore who are going to be feeling this closure in day-to-day life, and for everyone affected by the port closure and its supply chain impacts, the President and the whole government will be here with you until everything is rebuilt stronger than ever. Our country put its arms around Florida when the Sunshine Skyway Bridge collapsed in 1980. America rallied around Minnesota after the bridge there collapsed in 2007. This will be a long and difficult path, but we will come together around Baltimore, and we will rebuild together.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg in the White House briefing room. He also said that any member of Congress who might think of opposing the president's request to have federal money rebuild the bridge in Baltimore, he said, today this is happening in Baltimore, tomorrow it could be your district, and we really need to stand together, red, blue, and purple, to get these things done. And he said it was too soon to say if regulations could be waived to rebuild the bridge faster or reopen the port quicker. But he said the president wants to, quote, tear down any barriers, bureaucratic as well as financial. Congressman Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, posting on X, as we first concentrate on recovering the victims, it is important that both the state and federal governments work together to immediately reduce the environmental and regulatory burdens that would hinder the rapid reconstruction of the key bridge. He was on Fox TV's affiliate in Baltimore this morning.
Well, you know, I was with several of my colleagues in Congress. Look, they're all shocked. They want to get this thing fixed as soon as possible. Obviously, we've got to get over the shock. We have to do the recovery process for those workers, you know, who apparently lost their lives on the bridge. But then we very rapidly have to get the port reopened, and then we have to rebuild that major thoroughfare for the East Coast. And it's going to take a lot of work because what we're going to have to do is cut through all the federal red tape. Normally, a project like that, we know because we're considering a third Bay Bridge span, could take decades through the federal regulatory process. We got to cut through the red tape, get the port reopened, then get that roadway reopened as soon as possible.
So talk about the conversations that will now happen in Congress in order to get that ball rolling.
Well, the most important one, I think, is actually to start moving on cutting red tape in incidents like this, where you have a major infrastructure project that has to be done because of a disaster. We have to, again, be able to cut through all the red tape. This is a replacement. This is not a new project. You know, we're not doing anything new here. We're just going to replace something. And again, we have to make it, instead of, you know, a 5 or 10 year project, we should make it just a 3 or 4 year project. But it will take years. There's no question about it.
And then talk about the economic impact of that, because we're talking about 15,000 workers at that port, and you don't have, you know, the commerce going in and out of there. Supply chain issues are a real concern. Just talk about the widespread impact of what's happened here.
Well, it is. It's not only to the port workers and their income, it's about $15 million a day, but it's also getting the lumber, the coal, the roll-on, roll-off products, you know, moving in the area. We have come to depend on that port. It's a great port, a modern port. We've come to depend on it. Obviously, the economy suffers when that port is closed. So our very top priority, again, recovery of the victims, but then we've got to get that channel dredged and reopened as soon as possible.
Congressman Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, interviewed on Fox News Baltimore this morning. Washington Post article reads, the Port of Baltimore was the 17th largest in the nation by total tons in 2021 and an important artery for the movement of autos, construction machinery, and coal. It handled 52.3 million tons of foreign cargo worth nearly $81 billion in 2023, according to Maryland data, and creates more than 15,000 jobs. Robert Hanfield, professor of supply chain management at Poole College of Management at North Carolina State University, joins us now on the phone to talk about the economic impact of the bridge collapse in Baltimore. Thanks for being with us. What does closing a port like Baltimore, even for a short time, do to the international supply chain?
Well, you know, the Port of Baltimore is one of the biggest importers of vehicles. They do what's called roll-on, roll-off, or ro-ro shipments. A lot of those are coming from Japan, from Toyota and Honda and others. So with the bridge collapse, certainly access to the port is completely blocked and will likely be blocked for at least 2 years as they rebuild that bridge. The other commodity that's impacted is coal. Baltimore is one of the biggest exporters of coal to other countries like China and India, so they will have to find other ways of shipping that product out, possibly through the Port of Virginia or Wilmington or others as well. As far as the vehicles go, they're going to have to probably move some of those shipments to places like Charleston. They have specialized facilities required for those kinds of inbound automobiles that are being delivered.
And what might that do to prices, and how long before that takes effect?
Well, I don't think the effect is going to be as bad as people thought. There is additional capacity at these other ports on the East Coast, and so many of them will be able to accommodate shipments that are in the ocean. There are a few ships that are actually waiting outside the port right now that will likely be diverted. So there may be some delays. You know, if you're waiting on shipment of a vehicle to a dealer, there may be some delays of those shipments. But in the short term, I don't think we're going to see too much of an impact, fortunately. The other thing, of course, is for the city of Baltimore and the people who work at the port, it's devastating. It will definitely be an impact on Baltimore and the level of activity going on around the port.
Before this bridge collapse, what was the state of the supply chain in the United States and internationally?
Well, you know, we're always seeing, unfortunately, supply chain disruptions. The Panama Canal, for instance, is experiencing a major drought, and that's significantly curtailed the number of ships that can go through that canal. The Suez Canal has been subject to Houthi attacks, and supports have been diverting around the Cape of Good Hope, which has added lead times to shipping and lengthier delays on shipments. So those issues have certainly been problematic. There's always, you know, political tensions, you know, climate events, other things that are always impacting supply chains. So organizations today really need to be prepared to deal with those kinds of disruptions as they occur.
We're talking to Professor Robert Hanfield from North Carolina State University. The supply chain was on the top of everyone's mind a couple of years ago with the COVID-19 pandemic. As we came out of that, what lessons were learned? Were any of them implemented to make disruptions like this bridge collapse a little easier to take?
Well, I think organizations have realized that these supply chains that we've relied on, you know, for so long, for everything from, you know, food and in the grocery store to vehicles to everything that we buy are indeed very fragile, and they're very extended. We still get a lot of our products from Asia and China. one thing that organizations have done is they have started moving a lot of their supply chains to Mexico. So we're seeing a lot of growth in imports from Mexico as a result of the free trade agreement. Mexico is much closer. You know, their people speak Spanish and English. It's easier to communicate. And it's much more resilient. You're much more able to get products shipped quickly, you know, in one day, usually by truck. So there's a greater movement towards nearshoring, or what they call friendshoring, to build these supply chains that are more domestically or locally based.
In the coming days, as the devastation with the bridge collapse is addressed, what will you be looking for signs of what may come when it comes to supply chains?
Well, I think what we'll be looking for is potentially you know, disruptions or shortages of certain types of commodities. You know, I think bulk commodities are a big you know, big part of the Baltimore port as well. We'll be looking to see how freight will be diverted. We might see, you know, more freight going over the road and might be longer. Most of the big retailers have their inventory in pretty good shape, so I don't expect major disruptions in the next little while. But again, we want to be looking for any other kind of disruptions that might occur, you know, weather conditions impacting Los Angeles. Los Angeles, you know, imports a majority of our freight into the country, as well as hopefully the issues at the Suez Canal and Panama Canal will clear up in the shorter term as well.
Robert Hanfield, the professor of supply chain management at Poole College of Management at North Carolina State University. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
On Wall Street today from Yahoo Finance, stocks rebounded after several days of red closings as the S&P 500 jumped to a fresh record and the Dow surged more than 475 points. The Dow was up 477, NASDAQ up 83, S&P up 44. Story from Forbes, Disney settled its state lawsuit with the board that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appointed to oversee Walt Disney World's special district. The board and Disney confirmed Wednesday, ending a lengthy legal battle between the media giant and Florida government and canceling a controversial development agreement Disney enacted that hamstrung DeSantis's political appointees. The legal battles are part of a broader years-long controversy between Disney and DeSantis as the governor targeted Disney and its special district, which the company previously essentially controlled as its majority landowner, after the company opposed the state's parental rights in education law, known by critics as Don't Say Gay. That reporting from Forbes. Governor DeSantis commented on this settlement today.
So we've always acted with all the Disney issues, parents' rights in education, replacing Reedy Creek and making sure that was a state control board, doing the, you know, nullifying these covenants at the 11th hour. Everything we've done has been in the best interest of the state of Florida. And we have been vindicated on all those actions. Going forward, we're going to continue to govern with the best interests of the state of Florida. So I'm glad that they were able to do that settlement. Those 11th hour covenants and restrictions were never going to be valid. We knew that. The challenge to the state oversight board to replace Reedy Creek, that's not going anywhere. Obviously, that was dismissed in district court. So we have an interest as a state in moving forward to make this region very strong. This oversight, tourism oversight board and that district is a big part of that. And I think that there's going to be ways where, you know, we can do things that are in the best interest of the state of Florida. And I think Disney can be a part of that. I mean, certainly you look at Universal, they're doing the Epic Universe. That's going to be a huge, huge game changer for this region. I got to think Disney would have an interest and maybe offering another one. The district will be ready to negotiate something to be able to be good for the state of Florida, be good for jobs, and be good for all those things. But, you know, I would just point out, a year ago, people were trying to act like that all these legal maneuverings were all going to succeed against the state of Florida. And the reality is, here we are a year later, and not one of them has succeeded. Every action that we've taken has been upheld in full, and the state's better off for that.
Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican of Florida, at a news conference in Orlando today, commenting on the news that Disney has settled its state lawsuit with that board that Governor DeSantis appointed. More from the Forbes article, Walt Disney World President Jeff Vallee said in a statement the company was pleased to end the state court litigation, adding the settlement opens a new chapter of constructive engagement with the new leadership of the district and enables continued job creation. A White House press release today reads, as part of the Biden Cancer Moonshot, a key pillar of the president's unity agenda, First Lady Jill Biden convened executives from leading health insurance companies, community health plans, and health plan professional associations to highlight recent commitments to expanding access to navigation services to help patients and their families navigate health care treatments for cancer and other serious illnesses. The White House says these companies, including Aetna, CVS, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and Humana, serve more than 150 million Americans. First Lady Jill Biden spoke at the start of the meeting at the White House.
Navigators guide patients and their families through the complex and daunting world of cancer. They help patients with everything from scheduling appointments to keeping track of medications to coordinating things like transportation and child care. When you have someone who knows the system by your side every step of the way, it changes everything. But for too long, these services weren't available to many Americans. That's because the proper billing codes didn't exist. And this meant that insurers couldn't pay for patient navigation services. So most medical practices couldn't provide them. So through the Biden Cancer Moonshot, Joe found a solution. His administration put in place new billing codes, ones that Medicare and other health insurers can use to pay for patient navigation services. But for those codes to help the most people, insurance companies need to use them, and that's where you all come in. So you've stepped forward. Using these codes means that most of your members can benefit from the support of patient navigators. And that choice will change lives and save them. It's just not the right thing to do for patients. It's also the right thing to do for your businesses. So patients with navigators miss fewer appointments, are more likely to complete their treatment, and are less likely to need to go to an emergency room or be hospitalized. So on the behalf of the president and me, I want to thank you all.
First Lady Jill Biden at the White House with the CEOs. The Biden Cancer Moonshot has the goal of cutting the cancer death rate in half by 2047, preventing more than 4 million cancer deaths, and also changing the experience of patients, families, and caregivers. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, which is free. Story from the Times of Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office has reached out to the White House asking to reschedule a meeting regarding a potential Israeli operation in Rafah, which the premier canceled earlier this week, a U.S. official tells the Times of Israel. Just a few hours ago, Netanyahu boasted of his decision to cancel the delegation of his top aides to Washington in protest of the U.S. decision to allow the passage of a UN Security Council vote that called for an immediate ceasefire and hostage release that didn't explicitly condition the former on the latter. Netanyahu said the cancellation was a message to Hamas that Israel would not bow to international pressure regarding the war in Gaza. The U.S. maintains that a Rafah offensive will not advance Israel's war aims because it will lead to even more civilian casualties, cut off the delivery of humanitarian aid, further isolate Israel internationally, and harm Israel's long-term security. That was from the Times of Israel. The prime minister did that boasting referenced in the article in a video he posted from Jerusalem with visiting U.S. Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida.
I thought the U.S. decision in the Security Council was very, very bad. Yeah. And the worst part about it, I think the bad thing about the U.S. decision in the United Nations Security Council was that it encouraged Hamas to take a hard line and to believe that international pressure will prevent Israel from, A, freeing the hostages, and destroying Hamas. And that, therefore, my decision not to send the delegation to Washington in the wake of that resolution was a message to Hamas. It was a message, first and foremost, to Hamas. Don't bet on this pressure. It's not going to work. And I hope they got the message.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a video he posted on his account on X. Later in Washington, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was asked about these reports. The Prime Minister is now interested in rescheduling a meeting between Israel and U.S. officials on Israel's announced plans to take military action against Hamas fighters in the city of Rafah in Gaza. And the Press Secretary confirmed, yes, they're talking again.
Our understanding is that talks are restarting between the U.S. and Israel about rescheduling that meeting that was supposed to be held this week on Rafah. So what is the U.S.'s understanding of why Prime Minister Netanyahu is having this apparent change of heart? Did the meetings with Defense Minister Gallant go particularly well this week and came to that conclusion?
So obviously I'm going to let the Prime Minister speak for himself on that first part of the question. What I can say on Israel more broadly, as you asked me about meetings that were held here. They were constructive discussions with Israel's defense minister over the last 2 days. Rafah was one of the many topics discussed with Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken, Lloyd Austin, and Bill Burns. The prime minister's office has agreed to reschedule the meeting dedicated to Rafah. So we're now working with them to find a convenient date that's obviously going to work for both sides. But his office has agreed to reschedule that meeting that would be dedicated to Rafah, which is a good thing.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre during her news conference in the White House briefing room. Story from the Washington Post, the State Department official working on human rights issues in the Middle East resigned Wednesday in protest of U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza, the latest example of dissent among government personnel bursting into public view. The U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller was asked about this at his news conference at the State Department.
We've seen the statement by a State Department employee, if that's the terminology, who quit over the policy in Gaza. Do you have any reaction to the resignation broadly and more generally about how State Department employees can express dissent?
Yeah, a few things. So one, just a factual note on the point about an employee. So she was a fellow at the State Department. And my understanding had just finished the first year of a fellowship that could have gone for 2 years and did not exercise her option to return for a second year as a fellow. With respect to dissent at the State Department, so there is a broad diversity of views inside the State Department about our policy with respect to Gaza, just as there is a broad diversity within the State Department about our policy in a number of important foreign policy issues, as there is a broad diversity of views and opinions throughout American society about this issue and others. What we try to do in the State Department, what the Secretary has instructed his team to do, is to make sure that people have an opportunity to make their views known. He wants to hear them. He reads dissent cables when dissent cables are authored on any issue. He meets with employees who have a broad range of views. He listens to their feedback and he takes it into account in his decision making. And he encourages other senior leaders in the department to do so as well. And that's what he will continue to do, and what we will all try to continue to do, because we believe that actually listening to dissent informs better decisions. Having decisions challenged helps us make better ones in the future. So it's something that we will continue to encourage and support.
I mean, to expand on that, I mean, is it helpful? What does it say about U.S. policy to have an employee or a contractor resign? Is that something that you think is fine if somebody disagrees with the policy?
Everyone can make decisions for themselves about what they're going to do. One of the things I would note, even in the first story that I read about this, the individual in question herself noted that she attends meetings where there are people who have the exact opposite view of hers and express them openly. And that's what we encourage people to do. And ultimately, they have to make decisions about their future employment status.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at his news conference at the State Department in Washington. Back to the Washington Post article, they say in an interview, this fellow said her focus had been promoting human rights in the Middle East and North Africa, work that was complicated by Israel's war and a host of accompanying moral, legal, security, and diplomatic implications for the United States. She said she tried to raise concerns internally with dissent cables and at staff forums, but eventually concluded it was pointless as long as the U.S. continues to send a steady stream of weapons to Israel. Ukraine's daily electricity imports, writes Reuters, will reach their highest this year on Tuesday after a series of Russian missile strikes on critical infrastructure caused blackouts in many regions, the Energy Ministry said. The attacks, the biggest of which came on Friday, have caused major damage to generating and transmission facilities, forcing Kyiv to halt power exports. Ukraine, which has an extensive civilian nuclear energy sector, was a net exporter of power before the invasion and subsequent Russian occupation of Europe's largest nuclear power plant. That was from Reuters. Today, the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for Energy Resources, Jeffrey Pyatt, held a news conference at the Washington Foreign Press Center, getting a question from a Ukrainian reporter about this issue.
Yaroslav Dolgopol, Ukraine Foreign News Agency, Ukraine. So, Ambassador, you mentioned about circumstances of Russian war in Ukraine, and I obviously have a question regarding Ukraine. Would you please reveal the long-term projects related to the U.S.-Ukraine interaction in the energy domain, and in context of the recent Russian attacks on the Ukrainian energy infrastructure? Does the U.S. administration have funding in the recently approved budget to help Ukraine in the energy sector? And is the U.S. planning to provide such assistance anytime soon? And if I may, I have then one more question.
Okay. So let me begin, Yaroslav, by just saying my heart goes out to the millions of Ukrainians who've been affected by the latest wave of Russian attacks that began on Friday. The biggest single series of airstrikes against energy infrastructure since the start of the war. This is a focus of tremendous attention across the administration, including Secretary Blinken. We are working very closely with allies and partners around the world. I also want to note just our tremendous, tremendous admiration for the Ukrainian energy workers who are responding to this situation. Just this morning, I had a long discussion with Volodymyr Kudrytsky, the CEO of Ukrenergo, the national grid operator. Volodymyr described to me the recovery efforts that are being made in Kharkiv, in Burshtyn, in Kryvyi Rih, in Dnipro, in Odessa. We have seen a complex set of tactics by Putin, who spent, by the way, hundreds of millions of dollars in munitions in these series of attacks. There has been tremendous progress over the past few days in recovery, but there has also been great damage. I will note some of the good news, which is that the passive protection measures that the United States and our European allies have been helping to support did prove its utility at a number of sites, but Putin was able to inflict significant damage as well. And I just want to underline how outrageous it is that the Kremlin continues to target these civilian objects with no military objective. Simply to cause pain and suffering among Ukrainian citizens. And we will respond. I will host tomorrow another in the series of G7 plus energy sector support videos that the United States helped to organize at the time jointly with our German allies starting in October of 2022. This will be one of the most important of these calls that we've done. We will have Minister Holoshenko from Kyiv, but also Mr. Kudrytsky and other Ukrainian officials to present their damage assessment and also their immediate requirements. We need to do several things at the same time. We will be seeking to mobilize immediate assistance, as we have been doing since October of 22, when these energy sector attacks began. We will also be continuing our work to focus on Ukraine's long-term objective of building a future energy system that is cleaner, greener, and fully aligned with European standards. But I want to emphasize also that Putin is failing. We are now at the end of the third winter of Russia's war against the people of Ukraine. Ukraine has demonstrated tremendous resilience, thanks in large part to the courage of energy workers from companies like Ukrenergo and DTEC. The lights have stayed on. Putin has failed in that effort. He has lost Europe as an energy market. And we are committed to ensuring that that failure continues.
Jeffrey Pyatt, Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Resources, today at the Washington Foreign Press Center. Some other headlines from the war in Ukraine. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights putting out a report saying Russia may have executed more than 30 recently captured Ukrainian prisoners of war over the winter months. And Russia continues to say that Ukraine was behind last Friday's deadly attack on a concert hall in Moscow that killed at least 140 people. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said today it's extremely hard to believe that ISIS would have the capacity to do it, and she said in order to ward off suspicions from the collective West, they urgently needed to come up with something, so they resorted to ISIS, pulled an ace out of their sleeve, and literally a few hours after the terrorist attack, the Anglo-Saxon media began disseminating precisely these versions. Back in the U.S., General Chance Saltzman, Chief of Operations for the Space Force, spoke about the service's mission, priorities, and challenges safeguarding U.S. space assets and interests against competitors like Russia and China. He was at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies Forum held in Arlington, Virginia. You can find his full speech and the Q&A from the audience, runs about an hour, at our video library, cspan.org. At the start of his remarks, he had this.
Before I get started today, I want to draw your attention to the fact that it is International Whiskey Day. And it's a little early in the morning, and I don't have anything up here, I don't think. But there is a distillery in North Carolina that is looking to age their bourbon for 3 years on Earth, followed by 1 year in space. It's true. They're going to launch the barrel enclosed in a titanium shell and then deorbit it after a year. And you can get a bottle of it for the low, low price of $75,000 per bottle. And if you've seen the 24 budget, you know I will not be, or the Space Force will not be purchasing one. But this is not the first time whiskey's been aged in space. Ardbeg in 2011 aged a Scotch whiskey on the ISS. And while some said it tasted like throat lozenges and rubbery smoke, others said the taste was out of this world.
General Chance Saltzman, Chief of Operations for U.S. Space Force at the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Studies Forum held in Arlington, Virginia. He is talking about Mystic Farm and Distillery in Durham, North Carolina, and the bourbon is called Mystic Galactic, and they hope to produce 1,500 bottles. Purchasers will also get a special tool to open the special bottle, a commemorative tasting glass, and a piece of one of the barrels from space, should they pull this off. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox each day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.